This episode of Linoleum Knife is brought to you by Ovid.tv.
That was a very announcery announcement that you just made.
Sometimes announcers got to announce.
I think you could go a little less like, hey, everybody, Fluffo shortening for your all of your baking needs.
Look, we're going to have an actual conversation about Ovid. It's an ad.
Tell me about Ovid this week, Alonzo.
Oh, well.
We love Ovid, we're happy to be talking about it with you.
Super cool. They are premiering Patricio Guzman's Best Doc winner from the Cannes Film Festival, The Cordillera of Dreams, which caps off a trilogy of films that he has made about, as they say in the notes, and I couldn't say it any better, the relationship between historical memory, political trauma, and geography in his native country of Chile. This is the first time it's been available on any streaming service, and Ovid is the only place to watch Patricio Guzman's major films.
It opened earlier in the year, right around the time of the virus coming along, and I remember it was playing at Lumiere over on Wilshire. I was like, I got to get out to see that.
Yeah, no, I've heard great
things. And then I got locked into this apartment for 7.5 months.
Funny how that happens.
Yes. I'll tell you something, Alonzo.
What's that, Dave?
You know, I've seen every film, and I understand every single thing about every film.
Oh, very deeply,
and
yes.
And can tell everyone anything they want to know.
Uh-huh.
Do you know that sometimes I think that thing that I just said is true, and then I realize that it is not?
Oh, wait a minute. Yes, I know that feeling.
Not only have I not seen Cordillera of Dreams, I haven't seen any of Patricio Guzman's films, and one of the, as we talk about, we say this all the time, one of the things about being a film lover and especially a person whose job it is to
keep up
and do the research and do the homework and see the things that have contributed to film culture in the history of cinema over the years. I am so grateful that things like Ovid exist because now I get to catch up on Patricio Guzman films.
Exactly.
And it's, you know, the world is crap right now, but this makes it a little better.
There you go. Yeah, it's, you know, I think what's cool about services like Ovid is that they provide not only access, but curation. You know, they really are going out of their way to make sure that they are including the work of really fascinating filmmakers from around the world. You know, obviously a lot of women filmmakers whose stuff isn't being seen elsewhere, filmmakers of color, filmmakers from, you know, Latin America and other parts of the world.
Other countries, yeah.
So, yeah, if you want to take a dive into sort of the next level of you know, global cinema that isn't just like, hey, this is the French movie everybody loves right now. Not that they don't have French movies too. Ovid is the place to go.
They, as we barrel into the election, they have a collection of 23 films that they are calling Democracy and Its Discontents.
No.
So
I has them.
Great. Yes. really great documentaries about Shirley Chisholm, the one called Unbought and Unbossed, which is a wonderful film. Also, Eugene Debs' American Socialist, is sort of, you know, go team.
Yeah, and the, very of the moment.
And so many others. Go to school.
There you go. So, yeah, check it out. It's Ovid.tv. And do they have a special deal for Linoleum Knife listeners? They have a special deal for Linoleum Knife listeners. Use the code Linoleum, L-I-N-O-L-E-U-M, and get 50% off your first 3 months. Use that promo code at checkout when you go to Ovid. That's O-V as in Victor, I-D as in David, .tv, Ovid.tv.
There's another exclusive that they have this week as well. It's just only on Ovid. It's a documentary called The Cost of Living, which is about the current impossibilities of making a living in Britain specifically, which I think would, if you're going to double feature something, you could pair it very nicely with Ken Loach's Sorry We Missed You.
Oof. Wow.
Yes. Really bum you out, but it'll, you know, get you up to speed.
There you go.
So yeah, this is from Sean Black, Blacknell, and Wayne Walsh. It's only on Ovid. Linoleum Knife.
A podcast of the cinema.
It feels weird to have the music come in after the spot. I don't know why. I guess it's just because it's a new thing that we're doing. And, yes. And so.
And you're not good with new things.
No, I do. I don't like change. But I do like ad money. So I'll learn to live with it.
Yes, you do that. You're Dave White. I'm Alonzo Duraldi. We're film critics.
Yes.
I'm the reviews editor at The Wrap and co-host, in addition to this show, of the
so many other
Breakfast All podcasts. Day, Who Shot Ya, and a Film and a Movie podcast. Please check those out, but thanks for being here.
I used to write film reviews.
Yes, but you're keeping the faith here.
I'm pandemically underemployed.
Indeed.
Currently. But, you know, I'm here with you.
Exactly.
My husband and co-host and co-critic.
Thank you.
And
you're here with the audience.
And I'm here with all of my Linoleum Knife friends.
Yes.
I can't see you. I think of it's like that old kids show Romper Room. You know, at the end with
the magic mirror.
The lady would host. She'd hold the magic mirror up and she'd say, I see Billy and Sally. Mm-hmm. And
yeah. Never said my name. I know you'll be shocked.
She said my name every week.
I bet. David was always visible through the magic mirror.
Well, you know, there are far too many of us. So there. I'll tell you something. I'm surprised that for all the chat about what's the male Karen, that they haven't just all decided that it's Dave.
Mm.
You know? Because what is more boring and generic and white than the name Dave?
I think that there's still an assumption of like kind of chillness that goes with a Dave or a Nick. like our friend Gary always complains that his name has become a punchline.
Well, the reason his name has become a punchline is because the name Gary is becoming obsolete.
Yes.
There's a study that was done where that particular name, no one is naming their child Gary. Not even like an old-fashioned family name like Garrison or yes. something, like nothing like that. Like, it's just sort of becoming extinct.
Where are all the Ralphs?
Everyone like 40 and over who has the name Gary... It's going to become like Wilbur, you know,
Horace,
or yeah, and so that's I think that's you know, it's funny. Here's it'll someday it'll come back.
Of course,
all the names come back. The girl names come back first. Mm-hmm. I found, and then come the boy old fashioned names.
I look forward to a whole new generation of Gladyses and Ruths. No,
you know what's going to happen? It's going to be a whole new generation of Jennifers and Lisas.
Oh, well,
because
did
that's
they ever go away?
We were,
though, really?
Oh, no, they totally did. Okay. Because when we were little kids, those were the girl names.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
And
I want Bernices.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
But I never get what I want.
And then you want Bernice to bob her hair.
I do.
Can you still smell the crab cakes?
A little bit.
A little bit.
A little bit.
I'm trying to get the lingering. This is why I don't make fish for dinner
at home
ever. I order it when I go out, but we haven't been out.
Right.
You know, anywhere. And so, so I got the hankering for some crab cakes.
Oh, how the ghost of you lingers.
Ordered them, made them up last night, mm-hmm. sauteed them up in the pan. They were so delicious.
They were.
But.
On a bed of arugula?
Yeah, I woke up this morning and I was like, oh yeah, crab cakes.
It's like that old...
It's still... They're still here.
Do you remember those old, the old air freshener commercial where the ladies come over to play bridge or whatever, and one of them's like, fish for dinner last night? She's not wrong.
So they're gone. So it's they'll be gone in a bit, I suppose. I guess what I'm going to have to take, I'm going to have to like scrub off the top of the stove, like lingering sort of oil droplets or whatever. Yeah.
Don't say droplets.
Droplets is a trending word, and so it's in my head.
Fine.
And I'll say it all I want. Gary. Yeah. How about that?
Fine.
We got some movies to talk about.
We do.
How many of them are good?
Let's say... A couple. At least a couple.
One.
Wow.
One and a half.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll be curious to see where this goes.
Well, The Trial of the Chicago 7 is not one of them.
Not particularly, no.
But it's the big one.
It is.
It's the big one of the week. It would have been in cinema theaters.
Yes.
If we were living in a different world.
It is a movie that I had issues with while watching, and then the further away from it I get and the more I read about like its historical inaccuracies and other issues regarding the film, it's like, oh yeah, this is even dumber than I thought it was.
The Trial of Chicago 7 is from Aaron Sorkin.
Boy, howdy is it ever.
Who wrote and directed.
Mm-hmm.
And it is about the trial of eight men in 1969.
When did it take place? 69. It was right after...
Go on.
Okay. The events transpired at the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. The trial happened after Nixon came into office and brought in a new attorney general.
Yes.
Much is made of this.
Yes. So the men on trial, Tom Hayden, who wound up marrying Jane Fonda, Rennie Davis, Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, David Dellinger, William Kunstler was the attorney.
The two guys who really aren't even sure why they're there, at least is the way the movie portrays them.
John Froines and Lee Weiner.
Yes.
Sorry, the fact that I skipped them and then had to catch up on them is weird. Not weird. It's sort of emblematic of what really happened because they weren't, there was no reason for them to be involved.
As the movie says it, which might or might not be true as we come to discover about just about everything with this movie, the idea was that they were thrown in so that the jury could let somebody go.
Yes.
And the eighth person
was Bobby Seale.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Black Panther.
Founder of the Black Panther.
And yes. And he, wasn't even there for the thing that they're all on trial for.
Right.
And there's a line in the film, and if this wasn't said out loud by anyone back then, that doesn't make it any less true. He was thrown into the mix because he was black.
Yeah.
And that would scare the jury.
Right.
The white jury. And would lead to a conviction. Fortunately, he did not cooperate with the trial. The judge was particularly noxious, and in spite of the fact that Bobby Seale's lawyer wasn't even present, he pushed through and made Bobby Seale sit there and be without representation, which is unconstitutional.
Right.
Eventually, in the middle of the trial, Bobby Seale's case was thrown out. It was declared a mistrial.
Yes.
But it was only because he refused to cooperate.
And it was only after the judge literally had him bound and gagged.
In the court.
In the court. Yeah. That it was like, I think we have a mistrial now. And
yes.
They did.
Yeah. So this trial went on for a very long time, and it was theater.
Yeah.
It was not a real trial. The assembled remaining seven, they weren't even all collaborating. It was, they chose these guys, and they chose these guys, and they chose these other guys, and brought them together as defendants. And they did it as a way to show the American public who, you know, the older American public who may have been, you know, upset,
terrified of the youth movement.
Upset about the 1960s and upset about the youth movement and upset about the civil rights movement.
And the protests against Vietnam.
Upset about the protests and upset about the Black Panthers. They assembled these guys to make a show of them, to make an example of them, to make theater out of them.
And to bolster Nixon's law and order bona fides.
Yes. If law and order sounds familiar to you, it's because our current garbage president keeps saying it. And this goes back to Nixon.
Yeah.
And that was something he ran on very, very distinctly, very, very publicly. It was an expression that he used a lot. Frederick Wiseman made a documentary called Law and Order at this time that touched on that and touched on, you know, how policing operated in the late 1960s. Shocker, the same as it does now.
And as with our current president, the irony of someone using the phrase law and order while also being a criminal is, right, you know, not lost on history.
Yeah. Because of that, this film is about the trial of the Chicago Seven. I mean, it is a courtroom drama.
Yeah.
From start to finish, you are in that courtroom almost exclusively.
Yeah.
And in spite of the fact that it is a historical drama about a real thing that happened, every twist and turn of action and of dialogue is emphatically about right now.
Yes.
This is a movie that is set in the past, that is about the years 2016 to 2020.
And probably best approached that way, because then I think that allows you to be far more forgiving of the wild historical license that is being taken here.
Aaron Sorkin never met a sledgehammer that he did not want to use and does so here. He takes what may have been minor moments in the real life situation and emphasizes them so heavily that it's as if the film comes to a complete stop so that he can make sure that everyone gets the point.
Yeah. The movie's big climax, it was actually a thing that happened midway through the trial and which didn't really happen. Like, it got shut down by the judge, Judge Hoffman. But, you know, it is repurposed in this movie, not only as a big triumphant ending, but also for all the people in the courtroom to do the slow clap.
The slow clap. You thought the slow clap was over, right? You thought it was such a cliche, and everyone was so aware of it that it was no longer...
Tell people what the slow clap is.
The slow clap is what happens when someone at the end of a movie says something, you know, shaking, you know, narrative shaking, something cathartic, something triumphant, something, you know, that pulls every bit of the story together in a great speech. Or it's a performance of something that really galvanizes the people who are watching. And then...
First there's silence, and then one person, and then more people.
Help me, Alonzo.
And then everybody comes to their feet, and it's a rousing applause.
And that... actually happened.
Do that
at the end of this film. Spoiler, sorry. It's in real life, if you want the spoilers, you just go read about the trial of Chicago 7 and learn your history. This is theater about theater.
Yes.
And therefore not to be taken as, you know, everything you need to know about the Chicago 7. And I will say this. Anyone born after 1962 or 3 If you were born after 1960, let's say that you were 9 years old, going on 10 when this happened, and maybe you weren't paying attention to it at all, right?
Yeah.
So pretty much anyone born after 1960, mm-hmm. you know, the very youngest of the baby boomers who had no connection to the activities of the 60s,
right?
The beginnings of Generation X, and everyone who came after. It's not like they're teaching this trial in high school, right?
True.
It's not like, oh, you should all be aware of this thing that happened after the Democratic Convention of 1968 because it's a warning to the future, you know? It's a warning about political activism. It's a warning about the right to assemble. It's a warning about free speech. It's a warning about agitating against the sitting government, you know? But they don't. This is not taught. If you're going to learn about this, it's because you saw, you know, a movie like this.
I was going to say, one of the several movies about the Chicago 7 that have been made before.
You're going to watch, you're going to have seen a movie about this and think, I would like to learn more. And then you're going to go read and learn and realize that the film you just watched, this one we're talking about today, is about 50% not real.
Yeah, I mean, you can kind of, you know, you talk about this as theater.
And I say 50%. Who knows what percent?
Exactly.
Okay.
It wasn't just theater on behalf of the government. It was also, you have, like, you know, Jerry Rubin and Abbie Hoffman from the Yippies, who promoted a very theatrical kind of activism and protest.
Yes.
So they unleashed their own level of shenanigans in the courtroom as well. So it's the kind of thing where, if you want to make a courtroom drama and you don't want it to be dry, this is the kind of courtroom drama you would be drawn to.
Yeah.
And then when you're Aaron Sorkin and you're just going to juice it up anyway,
yeah,
you know, then you're just going to, the whole thing gets squared, cubed, you know, whatever.
Right.
And on that level, yes, it is entertaining and there are some performances that are captivating and some that are a little iffy. And I think if you don't take this, like I said, if you don't take this as actual history, and if you take it as a commentary on the present viewed through the filter of the past, there's some enjoyment to be had here.
Right. There are some good performances, for sure. Mark Rylance.
Yes.
As the...
As William Kunstler.
As William Kunstler, who is the defense attorney. Yahya Abdul-Mateen.
Yes.
Who I do not know.
He was on Watchmen, which you did not
Was
watch.
He? Okay. Yes. All right. Well, he plays Bobby Seale.
Yeah, he's true.
He's good. I love John Carroll Lynch as the pacifist dad who is part of this whole situation. He's like 20 years older than everyone else on the stand. Jeremy Strong plays Jerry Rubin in a way that is charming, and I liked him. He's from that show, Succession.
Yes.
Sacha Baron Cohen.
Oh my!
Is, while I appreciate his performance and how it varies between comedy and
seriousness.
Dramatic seriousness. What in the heck is the Massachusetts accent that he is doing? Mm. I don't know.
It's one of those mustache wears him situations.
Yeah, it really is a strange
choice
thing to hear him speak in this movie. Eddie Redmayne is Tom Hayden. He's fine.
Yeah,
you know.
I like Frank Langella as Judge Hoffman. I always like Frank Langella.
So,
Michael Keaton has like 2 or 3 scenes, and they're great.
Well, but I, you know, like...
Is it distracting when Michael Keaton shows up?
It is distracting. To me, it's distracting when Michael Keaton shows up, because I see him and I first think, Beetlejuice. And there's so much of him in Beetlejuice that when he speaks on his own, all you can do is be reminded of Beetlejuice. So...
That's not my go-to, but okay. Birdman, no, Beetlejuice.
No. Then again, the same with Batman. My next thought is, okay, Batman. Beetlejuice and Batman. It's Beetlejuice and Batman. He's a movie star who brings so much of himself to roles, no matter how outlandish or comic book-like they could be.
Right.
That when you hear him after those things, after they've left such an indelible mark. I don't remember anything about Birdman, honestly. Other than that, it hates film critics.
Theater critics.
Theater critics. Critics. It hates critics. Okay. A guy like Michael Keaton, it's hard for me to pull him out of the things I already know.
So if we ever went back and watched Clean and Sober or something, you would still... That would be the thing.
I saw Clean and Sober, I think, after the other stuff. Or before the other stuff, maybe.
It came out before the other stuff. But
well, that's why I saw it.
Okay.
Because I remember seeing it in the theater. Yeah. And so the answer to your question is no. I didn't have those associations.
Gotcha.
When I saw him in Clean and Sober. Which is, my memory tells me, a good drama about alcohol.
That's what I hear. I've never seen it. It's from the Moonlighting guy.
It is.
Glenn Gordon Carey.
I would have to go back and look at it again. Because when I saw it, I was really under-distanced from that subject matter.
Sure.
I had just started going to Al-Anon.
Oh, wow.
And adult children... English is my first language. Adult children of alcoholics meetings. And so... It was a pretty raw time in my young life.
And that was you chose that for your motion picture entertainment when you were going through that stuff for reals?
Of course.
Okay.
Of course I did.
All right.
I was like, oh, it's a movie about people I know.
Fair enough.
Maybe I'll learn something.
There you go.
And I don't know if I learned anything or if I just felt a lot of things.
Gotcha.
I'd have to see it again.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Times change. Your opinions on films change.
That's true.
As we said yesterday or the day before in some other venue, some other podcast, when I was 5, I loved the film Santa and the Three Bears. Not a good movie.
Yes. Yeah. The art doesn't change, but the world around it does.
So, bottom line, Aaron Sorkin gives you the talky talk talk.
Yeah. And if you're a fan of that, then, you know, tie a napkin around your neck and, you know, just dig into this.
Because that's what he wants you to do.
Yeah.
I'm real hit and miss with Mr. Sorkin.
It ditto.
Sometimes I find him engaging, sometimes not. I read somebody on Twitter this weekend kind of summed it up for me in a way that I felt was true, and I wish I could remember who said this, but Sorkin thinks he's good at telling you about government and politics in American life. But what he's really good at is showing you rooms full of friends arguing with each other.
Oh, also, by the way, you before or after you watched Trial of the Chicago 7, Kevin T. Porter of the Good Christian Fun podcast put together a fun little...
always going viral, that Kevin T. Porter.
A fun little supercut of lines in this movie that Sorkin is repurposing from his other work.
Yes. Like, totally lifting his own material from earlier material.
From West Wing, from Newsroom, from different places. Like, oh, well, you know. And look, I bet most writers would not hold up to that level of scrutiny.
I repeat myself I know, all the time. Wouldn't.
Yeah. Yes. So, I feel for you, and yet I snicker. Anyway, so yeah, it's on Netflix. If you want to watch it, it's there waiting for you. This episode of Linoleum Knife is also brought to you by Film Movement Plus.
Hey, what's that?
A streaming service that features an extraordinary array of international cinema. And they are getting ready to celebrate. Do you know what tomorrow is?
Tuesday.
October 20th. It's International Chef's Day.
Oh, it's a day about me.
Yeah, what are you getting me for International Chef's Day? Well,
we have a box of Kraft Mac and Cheese Deluxe sitting in the pantry. It's got your name
Deluxe.
On it.
Deluxe. Well, you don't
not the powder.
No.
The squeezy goo.
The pouch.
The pouch of squeezy goo.
Yes.
That's orange, just like the powder, but that you squeeze. That's into the cooked macaroni, and no adding, you don't have to add the milk
or the butter, nothing.
No, just nothing.
It's just there.
It's already squeezy goo ready for you.
Well, you don't have to get me anything for International Chef's Day because Film Movement Plus is giving me a documentary called Cooking at the World's End, which I got to see this thing because it's all about Spanish cooking.
And you know, I like Spanish things. Clearly, I married one of them.
There you go.
Yeah.
So yeah,
I married a Spanish thing.
It's a documentary about. Have you heard of this Grupo Nove? It's
no, I don't know anything about them.
An association of leading chefs who joined forces in 2003 to revolutionize Galician cuisine.
This is why I never want to be known by anyone as an actual foodie, because I know exactly one Spanish chef.
Mm-hmm.
That is my boyfriend, Jose Andres.
Yes. Well, these guys now have a total of 8 Michelin stars, so okay. Attention must be. Galicia, by the way, is the shelf of Spain that's above Portugal.
Yes, please explain it to us.
It's like, well,
you know more than
what do I they, do. What do they call the thing in Oklahoma, that the part that sticks
out? The panhandle.
The panhandle, thank you. That's the word I wanted. It's the panhandle of Spain.
Okay.
It's the part that's above Portugal. Anyway, I'm not really sure what Galician cuisine entails. I imagine there's a lot of seafood.
Well, we're fixing to find out because we are watching this.
Yes.
I love food documentaries of any sort. Mm. I'm a huge Chef's Table watcher, and we just reviewed the Ottolenghi documentary.
Yes.
A couple weeks ago. And so absolutely, absolutely going to watch this, because what if I learn something that leads to me making you something from your homeland?
I'm excited.
Yeah.
They're also doing this thing right now that's rather cool, that is going to kick off later this week, or Friday on the 23rd. It's called Nifty Online, and it's NFFTY, which is the National Film Festival for Talented Youth. It is a film festival for emerging filmmakers. It's based in Seattle. And Film Movement Plus will select 17 of the short films that played at the 2019 festival. And every Friday, they're going to be debuting new ones. So, and I'll tell you, as somebody who has worked in film festivals for a long time, you would be amazed at how many of the emerging filmmakers who you see their first feature, like, wow, where did this person come from? And they had some short films in festivals. Mm-hmm. You know, when I started working at USA in the early 90s, I remember seeing early shorts from like David O. Russell and Alexander Payne and, you know, people like that. So it's always cool if you have, you know, the wherewithal to keep an eye on festival short films, because those filmmakers are going places, and Film Movement is one of the places where you can watch them.
The other thing I'm stoked about is that the Wild Goose Lake drops on the 23rd.
Oh, nice.
Of this month. And it's funny.
You reviewed that on the show, right?
Well, no, I didn't.
Oh,
if you recall,
it was, we meant to. Right.
It too, harkening back to the ad that opened the show, yes. It too opened around the time that the virus started shutting everything down, and I did not get a chance to get out to the theater to see it. And I've been wanting to do that. In fact, just 4 days ago, I sat down and compiled a list of films that I've missed this year that I want to bring back and watch and review as though they were brand new. because we always barrel into the end of the year as critics, trying to catch up on the things that we've heard are worthwhile. And so often, you know, you're just one person. You can't get to everything.
Right.
But you're expected, in any case, to make lists. You, particularly, are expected to vote for LA Film Critics.
Yes.
And so I had this idea of, like, let's just pop one in per episode of a film that came out between January and now that we didn't get a chance to see, that was supposed to play theatrically and didn't, and then went to a virtual cinema and had to compete with the 35 other virtual cinema offerings that week, you know. So The Wild Goose Lake is a Chinese film. It's this sort of neo-noir that drops on Friday on Film Movement Plus, and I'm going to watch it, and we're going to review it.
Awesome. All right. I look forward to that.
So,
there's just so much waiting for you to check out over at Film Movement Plus. And if you are a listener of this podcast, which I'm guessing you are, you get a 30-day free trial plus 50% off your first 3 paid months. Use the promo code KNIFE at checkout, KNIFE, and that's at filmmovementplus.com.
Let's talk about Charm City Kings.
Oh, yeah.
Directed by Angel Manuel Soto. Screenplay by Sherman Payne. Now, It comes from and is inspired by a documentary.
Yes.
By Lotfi Nathan. But they've taken the documentary subject matter and incorporated it into a fictional narrative.
Which Barry Jenkins has a story credit on.
And Barry Jenkins has a story credit on this, along with Christopher Boyd and Kirk Sullivan.
Right.
It's about a young middle school kid, 13-ish?
12, 13, yeah.
Nicknamed Mouse, played by Jahi Diallo Winston. And he has a little sister and an older brother who is deceased. We don't know exactly how or why at the beginning of the film. He lives with his mother, who is a nurse?
She's a nurse.
Okay. And she's played by Tiana Paris, the awesome Tiana Paris from Mad Men.
Yes.
And he works part-time in an animal hospital for a local veterinarian. And his childhood wish was to be a veterinarian.
Right.
This has also become his mother's wish for him. Yes. She talks about it a lot. But he's also drawn to the bike culture of West Baltimore that his older brother was a part of.
Yes.
And so that bike culture, as seen in the documentary, the documentary is called The 12 O'Clock?
The 12 O'Clock Boys. Or sorry, 12 O'Clock Boys.
12 O'Clock Boys. Meaning that they can take their bikes and point their bikes straight up like it's 12 o'clock and ride them that way too. Which, come on now. Like, I'm happy that you can do this. Absolutely terrifying to watch because no one's wearing a helmet.
Yeah, you're giving me a heart attack.
And I'm, every time someone in the film does it, because it's like they use, you know, guys with bikes from the area, you know, in the film.
Yes.
And so all these bike stunts are happening in the film and you're thinking, oh, don't die. Like, it's so frightening. So it's thrilling to watch. Like, oh, look what you can do. Like, it's very exciting.
It's like watching other high diving at the Olympics. You're like,
yeah. That other part of me, yeah, exactly. That other part of me is thinking, oh, God, please do not crack your skull open on the pavement. I'm a scaredy cat about many things. Mm. Helmets, one of them.
We're going to talk about American Utopia next week after you get a chance to catch up with it. But at the end of the film, this isn't a spoiler, after the show is over, David Byrne and the whole onstage ensemble basically get on bikes and bike through New York City.
Bicycles or?
Bicycles.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. And it's very sweet. But David Byrne has...
Because these are like motorbikes this film.
Okay. I understand that.
Go on. Yeah.
David Byrne...
I'm explaining it to the folks listening.
Okay. David Byrne has a bicycle helmet. And then he also has like a giant cap that goes on top of the bicycle helmet.
To keep the helmet warm?
No, so it doesn't look like he's wearing a bicycle helmet. It just looks like he's wearing a big hat. Which I'm like, okay, I guess it's the best of both worlds.
Okay, David Byrne.
Exactly. It's very okay, David Byrne. But yeah, nonetheless, at least he's wearing that helmet.
So his fascination with the bike culture butts him up against his mother, who is dead set against it.
Does not want him following in the brother's footsteps.
Yes, because the brother is dead.
Yes.
And so she's afraid she'll lose another son. And he goes out and gets a secret bike anyway. It's like this like three-wheeler. Yeah. Like, what do you even call a bike?
I don't even know. They're like smaller dune buggies. I don't know what those are called, but you know, those three-wheelers.
Every time I see one, I just think, oh, that's like a riding lawnmower that just goes really fast. Like, I don't know what those bikes are, what they're called. Any case, he winds up hanging out with Meek Mill. Now, this Meek Mill plays a character named Blacks, but Meek Mill is the rapper that, that you know, is famous. And so this is his first film role.
And he's extraordinary.
He's great, yeah. There's more with the plot. In order...
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say Mouse is sort of torn between two potential mentors, one of whom is the Meek Mill character, and then one of whom is a police detective named Rivers, played by William Catlett, who, yes, if you watch Lovecraft Country, you just saw him in the Rewind 1921 flashback as Tick's grandfather, who is sort of trying to keep an eye on Mouse and sort of, you know, keep him on the straight.
So he has two father figure mentors in the story. He prefers Meek Mill. And a series of events takes place that leads Mouse into a difficult situation that involves the bike being stolen, his need for money. Someone recruits him to sell drugs. And that's kind of where it started to fall apart for me. Because here's a big cast, and everyone giving good performances.
Yeah.
There is a drama here about a family and a young boy, and, you know, the girl he's trying to impress, and the culture of, you know, stunt bike guys that he's trying to impress and become a part of. The older man who's looking out for him, and that would be enough.
Yeah.
And it becomes a film about stuff I've seen over and over again.
Yeah.
And I wonder why that I have to see, you know, the same story play out over and over again. There are more black stories than this.
Sure. No, no.
And there should be more room for black stories that do not involve a 13-year-old kid who has to learn how to sell drugs.
I acknowledge that. And I think, actually, weirdly, after watching the 40-year-old version, that sort of popped out for me more.
Well, yeah, because I watched 40-year-old version after this and thought, you're telling me the thing that I thought while I was watching Charm City Kings.
Right.
We'll get the 40-year-old version in a minute.
I grant you that, and it did cross my mind, but I think because of all the things that you note that this movie has in its favor.
And it does have a lot of them.
I was okay with it going there, even though, yes, it's a trope we've seen a million times. But I thought, at least it's a trope we're seeing with this really good cast, with these interesting characters. It's being directed really, you know, thoughtfully.
Okay.
So I was like, it almost felt
then
like,
tell me something new.
No, I can't.
If you're gonna take that path,
yes,
you know, then tell me something new.
I can't quibble with that.
Right.
But I'm just saying, for me personally,
you could, but
no, I mean,
would you be correct?
I mean, ultimately, yes, I agree with you, except for the fact that there was so much about this movie that I liked that I was kind of like, all right, we're going to do this. Okay, then let's do this. And it did it fine. It just didn't do it in a way that was different from all the other times we've seen them do this.
There's been a movement lately, mm-hmm. you know, among, you know, black filmmakers,
yes,
to take control of the narrative,
right,
and make everything not have to be about trauma,
yeah,
pain, suffering. In the words of Rada Blank in 40-year-old version, poverty porn.
Right,
she says this in that film. But in spite of you know, competent direction and a cast that's doing good work, that's still what we have here.
Yeah, I hear you. It's sort of like how when the people behind Pose were like, you know what, we're not going to do the, like, murdered trans woman storyline.
But,
like,
they did.
Oh, that's true.
Candy was murdered.
That's true.
And, however, the reason you don't remember it as a dominant quality in the course of the series is because it's a series.
Yeah.
And so there's been a lot of opportunity for other storylines to be happening. It's not just a story about one young trans woman who gets murdered.
Right.
Right. One character in the many, many, many characters of Pose.
True.
Winds up dead in the way that we learned about God, why am I? Venus Extravaganza?
Yes.
In Paris is Burning. Yes. I was blanking on her name. But like, because Pose is a series that has gone on for two seasons now, there have been opportunities for so many other storylines to happen. Sure. So even though you remember Candy's death and you remember that elaborate funeral sequence where she comes back to life and sings and all that stuff, it's not the only story.
Right. What I was thinking of was, I think there was a moment in season one where it seemed like Angel was going to be in a situation where that was going to unfold. And they were like, nope, we're not telling that one. We're not going to do that one.
Yeah.
And you're right. A series does allow multiple opportunities. I don't know if this was this is how we got this made situation. I don't know the backstory here. I acknowledge everything that you're saying is true, but it didn't get in my way of liking the things I like.
It's not a bad film.
Yes.
In spite of my reservations.
I understand. No, I totally understand.
Because again, the performances really do carry it, especially Meek Mill, who I now hope winds up in more movies.
Yeah. Yeah. I would love to see him branch out.
It's more good than bad.
Fair
Is
enough.
That what we want to say?
Okay, yeah. It's right. On HBO Max. You should watch it.
And it has your favorite new song in it.
Yes. Thanks to Charm City Kings, I learned about the song Church by Sam Henshaw, which I really like.
It's a good song.
It is.
Yeah. Let's now talk about the 40-year-old version.
Yes.
Because it's relevant to the discussion of Charm City Kings, I think.
Yeah.
40-year-old version is... Why don't you...
Sure.
Go, because after we're done with this, I'll be, leading us through The More You Ignore Me.
Oh, right. Yeah, oh, so, by the way,
yes.
I have seen Honest Thief. We are not reviewing Honest Thief until it becomes available on streaming platforms, because...
Currently,
going to movie theaters is a bad idea.
Yeah,
right now.
It is. Honest Thief, the new Liam Neeson action film, is currently only in theaters.
Yes.
And we do not want you going to movie theaters right now because it is not safe. And because there is no clear or announced streaming window for this movie. No date for when it's going to stream.
When we talked about Kajillionaire, they had already said when the streaming dates were happening. But not.
I'll talk about a movie that's only in theaters now if you can tell me that it's going to stream in 10 days, 3 weeks, something. Yeah. Give me a date. Until then, no.
Right.
Because, Liam Neeson's fans.
Can wait.
They can wait. Yeah.
So, 40-year-old version is written, directed, starring Rada Blank, who is a New York playwright.
And a screenwriter.
And screenwriter.
For TV.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And she plays a pushing 40 New York playwright.
Fictionalized version of herself.
Yes, with her name.
Yes.
She was named a 30 under 30, but now she's almost 40 and, hasn't.
And no one's got a 40 under 40 list.
Exactly.
For her to be on yet.
Now, her stuff hasn't been produced in a while. She's been teaching high schoolers, and she gets an opportunity to get one of her plays produced, but the guy producing it has really terrible ideas about, sort of making it more, making it approachable and mainstream and, all that kind of stuff. And as he is chipping away at her play, she discovers that she wants to rap, that she has rhymes, that she has things to say. She has things to say that are very uniquely about being a 39-year-old woman, which is not a very representative voice in the world of hip hop.
No.
And so she connects with a producer named D, and starts sort of exploring that that avenue and trying to figure out if it's a crazy pipe dream or it is a sort of a legitimate means of expression for her, especially when she finds, you know, so much of the mechanics of theater and getting your stuff produced to be so off-putting. Peter Kim is a character actor you've probably seen in stuff, plays her lifelong best friend and agent, who is gay and Korean, and they were each other's prom dates. And they're still the people who can say the stuff to each other that nobody else right. will say.
Yes.
This movie is so smart and funny and revelatory about, well, first of all, I did not know who Rada Blank was, and now I'm a huge
right.
fan.
Right.
But also, you know, a theme that I'm sort of picking up on this year, for myself at least, is that there is no such thing as a played out genre when you haven't seen other communities get to have that genre.
Uh-huh.
So, like, you know, I talked about that episode of Lovecraft Country where it's very sort of Raiders of the Lost Ark and a bunch of, you know, like traps and you know, stuff and trying to get to the thing.
Uh-huh.
But I'd never seen it with a trio of black characters making their way through it.
Right.
On the Rocks, which we're going to talk about next week, the new film from Sofia Coppola, is another very sort of like glossy, bougie New York story. But again, populated with a black cast, which is not something I've seen before.
Mm-hmm.
This is a kind of coming of middle age movie and mm-hmm. a artist discovers their voice movie.
Yeah.
But it's about a 39-year-old black woman and I've never seen it told that way before.
Right. It is smart and it is very aware of itself. It is funny. And what centers the entire film is Rada Blank.
Yeah.
As Rada Blank. She is, as a screenwriter, she's unafraid to make this character not always sympathetic.
Mm.
You watch her behave, you watch the way she behaves with other people, and sometimes, as you're watching it, you think, why are you being that way? You know, why are you unkind
yeah.
to this person? Why are you being such a jerk to this other person? There are, in every human being, there is jerkiness, there yes. is inconsistency, there is cruelty. And in little flashy moments, not flashy, but little flashes of moments, you see her do this. And yet you remain sympathetic to her as she tries to figure out where her life is going. You see her relationship blossom with this producer that she meets, the guy named Dee, played by Oswin Benjamin. It's his first film.
Huh.
Yeah. You see the relationship she has with her students, many of whom don't quite understand, you know, what it means to, you know, create theater. And some of the other, there are a couple of kids in the theater group who are at odds with each other because of all these, you know, associations that she has with so many other characters. The film meanders a lot from, you know, scenario to scenario. It's not a completely like straight line for her.
It runs at a little over 2 hours and could maybe,
it tries to pack in a lot.
Yeah. Could have been tightened a little.
But when it gets to where it's going, what it has to say about not only the completely ridiculous idea that aging diminishes you.
Right.
Right. It has a lot to say about that, and it has very specific things to say about black cultural offerings created for white people.
Yeah, or at least underwritten by white people.
There are at least three references in this film to
The Color Purple.
Miss Sophia
yeah.
in The Color Purple. And as I watched this film, I thought, oh, wait. You know, I'm a film critic. I've been writing about film for 20 years. I've been watching it my whole life. I've been studying it. And I would say that as a middle-aged white male viewer, I've actively, encountered more black film than a lot of white people my age. So I think I'm pretty savvy, right? What if I haven't been? Meaning, what if, and I don't know how much, I don't know the percentage because I don't see how the sausage is being made, right? What if black film that has resonated with me, for this or that reason, comedically, dramatically, whatever, what if I was being pandered to because I am a white audience member? In this film, and the reason I'm saying these things is because in this film, the white producer of her play, of Rhoda Blank's play that she's trying to get produced, keeps interjecting, right? He keeps pushing her to add a sassy older woman who dispenses wisdom that no one wants to hear. And
More
then
white characters.
you see that very character on the street corner dispensing wisdom to Rhoda Blank that Rhoda Blank does not want to hear. The white producer then says, "Well, we need more white characters. If your play is about gentrification, we need to see who's gentrifying. We need to have them be a part of the story." And then the film shows the white actor literally separating the two black actors from each other as she comes in and stands front and center. And each time this happens in the film, each time the white producer tries to destroy this play, I think, what films have I seen that did this? What TV shows have I seen that did this? And I didn't notice because I'm the white viewer. You know what I mean?
It's one thing to dunk on something as obviously ridiculous as Green Book that's made by white people. But yeah, but like what are the, is she subtweeting, other black creators for like taking these notes?
One of my favorite supporting characters is the guy who runs the black theater.
Oh, Umoja.
Yeah, the one, the, and he's a theater director who, doesn't want to give her a full production. He wants to give her a workshop. And she's like, no, you see this white producer over here is wants to give me a real run. And he's like, fine, go do it. He comes to see the final product that she's made, and he sits in the audience and rolls his eyes and fans himself. And I'm glad his character was there because as I was watching the final product play out, I thought, we all know this is a terrible play
Yeah,
that's
her
being
play becomes springtime for Hitler,
it's it
basically.
is bonkers.
Yeah.
It's like her play becomes the film Crash, not the Cronenberg one, the other
The
one.
Oscar-winning one.
And when you watch this movie and you wonder who she's talking about. And you wonder if she's talking about herself,
Sure.
knowing what she may have had to personally compromise to get her career moving forward,
Yeah.
as a screenwriter, as a director, how much creative freedom did she get from Netflix, or whoever produced this? I don't know if Netflix acquired this or produced it or what,
I think they
but
acquired it, but I'm not sure.
so many questions become opened up. And so, yeah, this movie's got a lot to say about cultural product, how it is created, for whom it is created, what are its intentions, how does money destroy things? How does a liberal white domination control stuff like this?
But this is also like a funny movie
Yeah, and
that's a
it's also
character
very funny.
piece. Like, first and foremost, I think it is a character piece. It is about this woman, like dealing with these various aspects of turning 40, of her professional life, of her personal life. I love the fact that She is very forthrightly like an object of desire for many people in this movie.
Yeah.
And films.
I always appreciate a fat main character.
Yes.
Who stays fat and gets sex.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that is such a paradigm that never gets to happen in most mainstream culture. Yep. She's unapologetic about that, and I think that's great. So yeah, it is about all those things that you said it's about, but I don't want to scare people into thinking that it's some sort of diatribe. Like, that's all woven into a funny character study and, you know, charming comedy.
Yeah. I liked it. It's too long, but
it's too long. Charm City Kings also too long. Both of these movies are like a little, and Trial of Chicago 7. Like, all these movies are over 2 hours, and not that movies, look, we watched Satan Tango, but, you know, I think these movies could have all lost a good 10 or 20 minutes along the way and, you know, and been just fine.
Alonzo.
Yes, sir.
Do you know what movie is also too long?
What movie is also too long?
The More You Ignore Me.
Oh, yeah. You watched this.
Do you know how long The More You Ignore Me is?
How long?
90 minutes.
But still, to quote the great Roger Ebert, no good movie is too long and no bad movie is short enough.
I'm so baffled by this film. All right, but I have to give y'all a little backstory first. This film is now, in October of 2020, opening in the United States.
Yes, if you're listening in the UK and wondering why we're talking about this now, that's why.
I don't even know how widely it opened in the UK.
Ah.
But it opened in the UK in July of 2018.
Oh.
Yeah, which means it was shot in 2017.
Gotcha.
So this movie is 3+ years old at this point. Directed by Keith English, but written by Joe Brand. Now, Joe Brand is a British comic actor, writer, novelist. She co-created the original series Getting On.
Oh, okay, which HBO remade.
Which HBO remade in the United States. She's been a big deal for a very long time. Before she became a writer, actor, director, novelist, she was a psychiatric nurse for 10 years. She wrote a book about that as well.
Okay.
This plays into the story. In 2009, she wrote a novel called The More You Ignore Me, which I'm sort of half compelled to read now.
Really?
Well, yeah, because this movie's so bad. I want to know.
Yeah, that's usually the guarantee that I will never read the source material, even if it's based on a great book.
I
want to
know if it, like, something got screwed up in the like, I don't know. All right? So there's some backstory for you.
Mm.
This is a movie that she has adapted from her own novel.
Yes.
That was in part informed by her career as a psychiatric nurse. Now, you may be a Smiths fan or a Morrissey fan, and you may recognize this title. This is the part of a song title by Morrissey. Not the Smiths, mind you, Morrissey.
No. Yeah.
This film is set in the 80s, and it stars Ella Hunt from Anna and the Apocalypse.
Oh, nice.
As a teenage girl who sees the Smiths for the very first time on Top of the Pops and immediately becomes obsessed with them. Why does she become obsessed with the Smiths? Well, the film never really tells you.
Yeah.
Only that she does. Specifically, she's obsessed with Morrissey.
Okay.
As a poet, as an object of beauty, really. And aside from the fact that over the course of the story, she begins dressing in black clothing,
okay,
you don't quite ever get a sense of what it is about the Smiths that she connects to. All right? She never once has a discussion about, like, you know, they say what I feel.
Right.
You know, he's talking to me. You know, she may say that like once.
I wear black on the outside.
Because black is how I feel on the inside, yeah. You know, she may say that once, like, oh, he's talking to me or something like that. So, but it's very much in passing.
This could have been a movie about The Cure, then.
It could have been a movie about The Cure. It could have been a movie about, like,
Bucks Fizz.
It could have been a movie about fairground attraction for all. You know what I mean? Like, it could have been a movie about
the Reynolds girls,
the Transvision Vamp. Like, it doesn't matter who the movie's about.
Gotcha.
It is about a teenage girl who becomes obsessed with a band. Mm. Her mother, played by Sheridan Smith, who is a British character actress, mm-hmm. And also a singer herself. She sings the closing song over the credits. She plays the mom with an unnamed mental illness.
Okay.
Occasionally people discuss, people throw out words like, you know, psychotic episodes, she hears voices, it feels like it could be some sort of like schizophrenia.
Yeah.
But again, the movie, it goes about as deeply into her mental illness as it goes into about why
the Smiths fandom
is happening. Mark Addy plays the father.
Hmm.
And he's very kind and caring, and he takes care of everybody, and he tries to keep the mother, you know,
stable.
They get her on medication that sort of puts her in a very sort of depressed state.
Mm.
You know, she just sits all day
right.
and watches TV. But instead of building empathy for this character or building a story on the specifics of this family's, you know, trouble,
yeah.
their need for, you know, each other. It does this weird thing with the Sheridan Smith character, with the mother character. It turns her into like almost a slapsticky comic figure, almost a grotesque figure. You know, close-ups of her eating chocolate in a real sloppy way. It's a strange sort of, I think, irresponsible way to bring up a character with mental health issues, you know, onto a screen.
Mm.
At some point, Ella Hunt's character, the daughter, says, "What if we turned down her medication for a bit? You know, I would like her to be, you know, more alive and engaged."
Mm-hmm.
So they do. And the minute that happens, the mother becomes obsessed with the Smiths as well. And again, we never know why.
Mm.
There's no reason. A series of events take place that puts the mom in peril. She gets committed to an institution. She breaks out of the institution. And then it becomes even more of like a wacky comedy like she runs off with a guy and then that's kind of the end. Like everyone's sort of happy at the end of the movie because the mom's run away from home and wants to divorce the dad. And she's, you know, attached herself to a new guy who doesn't quite understand the history of her life. And again, there is no good reason for the Smiths to be a part of this film at all. I watched it because I reviewed England Is Mine,
right?
The Morrissey biopic for The Wrap whenever it came out, like last year or the year before. I don't remember exactly when. But when I heard that this was coming, I thought, well, I guess I have to watch it, right? I'm a Smiths fan from back in the 80s myself, mm-hmm. you know, now that I'm a very old man. I was young when they were young. And
okay, boomer.
Yeah, well, what are you going to do? This is bad.
Mm-hmm.
This is such a bad film.
Well, and you were also telling me that they don't even get some of the, like, obvious basic historical details correct.
Well, you know, I mean, like, there's one thing that they get weirdly wrong. The big concert at the end that the teenage daughter and the mom are supposed to go to.
Mm-hmm.
They get up to the venue and the marquee just says Morrissey. And I'm like, oh, are we in 1989 now? Like, wasn't it just 20 minutes ago that she saw them on Top of the Pops for the first time? Like, what's happening?
Well, and the title of the movie, right?
The title of the movie is also not a Smiths song. It's from later in Morrissey's career. Those are quibbly little bits, right? Those two things that I complained about.
I thought people might have that. I didn't want to have that be the unanswered question.
I'll tell you, the more you annoy me, movie. It's, yeah, I mean, like, the more you ignore me, the closer I get is from 1994.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it doesn't really, that's me being a know-it-all fan. But
that's kind of a big detail, though.
I guess. I don't know. I just, like, I want to know what went wrong. I want to know.
It'd be like making a movie about a Fleetwood Mac fan. And
has anyone read this book so that I don't have to? Will you please tell me about it? And do they get anything about family trouble? Like, because that's the core of the movie, is this family that's splitting apart because of the mother's mental illness. The movie treats it very almost like jokey. Yeah, on one level, I guess there's a defense to be made of a very particular sort of British muddle through it sort of, you know, tone, which it does possess.
Yeah.
But you can muddle through all you want, and you still have a problem that needs something other than a goofy ending to solve.
Right.
You know.
Okay, then.
If you're morbidly curious like I was, it's streaming. You can watch it now. Mm-hmm. But dang. The publicist was sort of like checking in with me for the past week. Like, have you watched it? Are you going to cover it? And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to watch it. We're going to cover it. We're going to talk about it on the podcast. And then I watched it and I didn't follow up on any other emails. I was like, you don't want to know what I have to say about this.
That's the worst. When people are like really enthusiastic for you to see something and you see it and you're like, oh.
There's a reason it's sat without an American distributor for 2 years.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yikes. And that's the one. That's it. We have now talked about all the films.
All right. Do we have letters?
We do have letters. I'll pull them up right now. This is kind of a long one from Jeremy.
Mm-hmm.
He says, relatively new listener, first-time caller. I've been following Linoleum Knife since the beginning of 2019. I found my way to you guys via Alonzo's appearances on The Sewers of Paris and Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast, so please be sure to thank Matt Baume and Nathan Rabin for nabbing you a new fan.
Oh, thank you.
Rather than run off a list of superlatives I could use to describe your reviews, why don't you just run off a list of superlatives, Jeremy? We like those.
And Dave also was on Sewers of Paris, by the way, so go back and
hear that episode if you missed it. Real early on, like one of like the first two or three, four episodes.
Yeah, you and I did our own.
I will point to a particular review that typifies what I think of the depth of perspective you bring to your work. Your review of Marriage Story was such a masterful, masterful, weaving of critical analysis and personal perspective that it is one of those instances where whenever I think of the film, I will think of your review. In much the same way that, for example, Carrie and McCabe and Mrs. Miller are inextricable to me from Pauline Kael's essays on them. But what moved me to write to you today was your episode-length discussion of The Boys in the Band. As a queer man born in 1978, and thus not really a Gen Xer and not really a millennial. Yeah, isn't it weird to be on the cusp?
Yeah, an Xennial.
Technically, you kind of are like a real baby Gen X age person.
Yeah, like a Winter and Karen.
Yeah, but like, you know, I'm a cusp as well. Depending on who's writing the think piece, I'm either the youngest boomer or the oldest Gen Xer.
Right.
Generations are marketing tools. I'm just going to say that again for the 11th time. But we'll continue now. I'm always finding myself in a place where my peers, culturally speaking, are people either slightly older or slightly younger than myself. Therefore, my impression of the Friedkin boys in the band was, for a long time, one that was informed by your generation's rejection of the film as an out of touch and possibly even destructive, with the queer nation / act up culture of the early 90s. So I was mildly surprised when, after watching the film a few years ago, to find myself actually kind of liking it. Yes, it's a film about gay men made in the 1970s, so fashions and attitudes have changed. But as a viewer whose tastes run heavily toward classical Hollywood cinema, that didn't bother me. I think I became somewhat defensive of the film since first seeing it, specifically because some of those dated attitudes, the self-loathing, the toxicity that certain friend groups can take on, are ones that I would argue still very much do exist, even if depicting queer people as such has become passé. Self-loathing in particular is something that afflicted me for many years, to the extent that it delayed my coming out and harmed several of my relationships with people in my life in ways that I'm still feeling the effects of, even as the now proudly married, proudly queer man I am today. In hearing your stories of yourselves and younger gay men viewing this film as, if not the enemy exactly, then at least as an unflattering downer, I think what I understand now is that much criticism of the film is not criticism of what it is doing so much as it is criticism of what was lacking in the culture of the 1970s. Dave cites numerous other queer films from the era, but these are arty and often experimental pieces, while The Boys in the Band was a major motion picture that, as Alonzo pointed out, employed the popular, chatty style of the American theater of the time. For too long, The Boys in the Band was the gay film.
Yes.
At the very least, as a child, I had the occasional affirmative depiction of queer people on special episodes of shows like Cheers or The Golden Girls, even if such affirmations were always accompanied by a barrage of gay jokes. In the end, this might be my very long way of saying that I am ultimately on the side of Harvey Fierstein's visibility at all costs, but I prefer to think of it more as visibility, warts, and all. Mm. As for the 2020 Boys in the Band, I lost all interest as soon as I heard that hunky Zachary Quinto was playing Harold, a character you rightly identified as the most memorable part of the Friedkin version. This only confirms to me what I've long suspected about Ryan Murphy, that he is a person with the best of intentions and the worst of judgment and taste.
I want to get that needle pointed onto a sampler.
If I haven't rambled on too long, I would also love to submit a list to be knife. Right. Well, you're the only letter this week, Jeremy. Yes. So yes.
The floor is yours.
This isn't not to say that there aren't other letters, but
yeah, we'll get to them.
We've got other letters, we're gonna get to them soon. This isn't a list of my top 10 favorite movies of all time, as much as it is what such a list might look like if I disqualified the likes of Hitchcock and Bergman and anything that generally makes those sight and sound lists. I'd rather get your reactions to some personal idiosyncratic favorites of mine than score easy points. So, in chronological order, Jeremy. You have almost stumped the band. I think there should be an award, right?
Oh, I think we've had people who've sent us 10 titles that neither of us had ever seen.
Are you sure? I don't think that's ever happened.
Maybe not. I don't know. But well, there's quite a few here.
There are, of the 10, yeah. 6 that we have not seen.
Yes. I know of them, and I know I need to see at least some of them, but have not
seen. One of
them
is currently sitting in our DVR waiting to be watched.
And one's a Christmas movie.
Let's go with the ones we've seen.
Okay.
Hal Hartley's Henry Fool.
Love it.
Same. Mick Jackson's L.A. Story.
You know, I like to revisit that one every so often now that I live here. And like, there's some things that doesn't get right and some things gets very right. Yes, I like it.
My Bodyguard from 1980, Tony Bill.
Fun fact.
Yes.
The first movie I ever really reviewed.
Really?
For my high school paper.
For your high school newspaper.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you have it? You ever written?
Somewhere in a box, probably. Yeah. That was, and also this, the first press kit I ever got.
Wow.
I figured out.
40
years ago. That was the movie that taught me like to find the publicist and get a press kit. They sent me the press kit for My Bodyguard.
Baby's first steps.
I felt so professional.
And without you, I'm nothing. Which is a touchstone in this home.
Oh, yeah. A movie that changed my life, no question.
And honestly, the film less so than the album of the stage.
I mean, both. The film led me to the album, but both of them.
See, I got to the album first.
Oh, see, I didn't.
Now, here are the 6. So, technically, your list is now 100% nice.
Yes, based on those
four that we've seen.
We're on board.
Here are the six that we haven't seen yet. Starting with I Wake Up Screaming, the one that is sitting in the DVR right
Yes, because I know it's a legendary noir.
1941. Yeah. 1931's The Fatal Glass of Beer.
Which I want to say is W.C. Fields, and possibly. I have not seen it.
1940's Night Train to Munich.
Heard of it, haven't seen it.
1970's Going Down the Road, which is a classic of Canadian
Yes, like the movie that cinema. Sort of launched the Canadian cinema, period.
Yes. Mon Oncle Antoine. 1971.
On my list of like obscurish Christmas movies that I have not gotten around to yet.
And Tenebre, Dario Argento.
Is that the one with Jennifer Connelly and the bugs?
Good question. It's from 1992, so quite possibly.
Oh, no. That was in the 80s. I'm not sure which one Tenebre is. I'm not a giallo guy. I'm not a horror guy. There's a lot of
Argento. I've seen Argento films. I just haven't seen that one.
I think I've seen Suspiria, and that might be it.
It's okay, Alonzo. No one's making you watch too much horror film.
I know.
It's okay.
I know.
Don't feel bad.
You don't have to condescend to me.
I'm not condescending. I'm cuddling you. Okay, right now. Fine. Giving you a cuddle.
Thank you. Hey, give our Patreon page a cuddle at patreon.com/linoleumknife. If you like this, we got more of it.
We have so many more podcasts that will be in your ears.
Yes. Linoleum Knife presents more Linoleum Knife, where we take a concentrated look at a single film title. LKTV, a podcast of the television. Linoleum Knife and Fork, a food podcast hosted by two film critics. And Linoleum Nights, where we do actual swearing and talk about trickier subjects.
Swearing. Sorry, my glasses were in my mouth.
And club meetings and daily recommendations and all kinds of other stuff. So yeah, check out patreon.com/linoleumknife. We think you'll find it worthwhile. Thank you for listening.
Well, we hope.
We
anyway,
do.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. Like I said before, check out my my other podcasts. Go to there's so many friends on the internet. See what Bibbs and Whitney are up to over the Critically Acclaimed Network. Check out Schmoes Know, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, The Comics Canon, Waiting to Exhale with Karen and Winter, All Things Cozy, Sewers of Paris, Deck the Hallmark, Big Fat Gay Podcast, Criterion Cast, Fat Guys of the Movies, Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts. Leave us that beautiful 5-star review. We'll read it on the show. You can also leave positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Spotify, Stitcher Radio, Amazon Podcasts, Google Play, CastBox, Podbean. Follow us at LinoleumCast at Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. You can find him and what he's up to over at his Twitter page, Blutopia, BLEUTOPIA. And, of course, finally, you can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We do have your letters. We will be getting to them. And, yeah, thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care of yourselves and each other. And until next time,
goodbye.